A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hannah sent us this one. She and Daniel have been apartment hunting, and she's been pretty open about her architectural skepticism toward residential towers. She thinks they're overused as a universal solution. They don't create walkable, human-skilled cities, and she's never seen them as ideal places for family life. But after months of disappointing options, they visited a unit high up in a downtown luxury tower, almost on a whim, and she genuinely loved it. So her question is basically this. How do you weigh the real lifestyle advantages and disadvantages of tower living once you're actually inside one? What surprises people, for better or worse? And how does the equation shift between renting and buying? She's especially curious about the risks people overlook when the private unit is great, but the shared environment isn't.
This is a fantastic prompt because it's the exact tension that architecture critics and actual humans have been wrestling with for decades. You can hate the typology in principle and still walk into a specific apartment and think, oh no, I want this.
The intellectual objection, meaning the visceral, yes.
And that's not hypocrisy. That's just being a person who lives in a real city with real constraints. Let's start with what Hannah already noticed, because she spotted the central fault line. You've got this strange bifurcation in residential towers between the private unit and the common space. The apartment has high ceilings, floor-to-ceiling windows, natural light pouring in, a trash chute, dedicated parking. All things that in a dense downtown are rare.
Trash chute alone is a lifestyle upgrade most people don't appreciate until they've carried a leaking bag down 4 flights of stairs.
It's the domestic equivalent of a private driver. But then she walks into the hallway and it feels institutional. And she's asking the right question. What happens when the common areas don't match the units? Because in a tower, the common areas aren't just a lobby you pass through. They're the circulatory system of the entire building. You're in them every single day, multiple times. And if they feel neglected, that wears on you in a way that's hard to articulate until you've lived it.
It's the difference between walking through a hotel corridor every morning and walking through a hospital corridor. Same dimensions, completely different psychological effect.
There was a really interesting study out of the University of Toronto a few years back that looked at exactly this. They surveyed residents across something like 40 residential towers in the Greater Toronto area and found that satisfaction with common areas was actually a stronger predictor of overall residential satisfaction than unit size or even view. People would trade square footage for well-maintained shared spaces and report being happier.
The view is spectacular for the first month. Then it becomes wallpaper. The hallway is mediocre on day one and stays mediocre forever.
Here's where the luxury branding gets deceptive. Hannah mentioned the building was developed as a luxury tower, and that label does a lot of heavy lifting in the marketing. But luxury and residential development often means luxury finishes in the unit and luxury amenities on the amenity list, and that's where the budget stops. The actual construction quality of the common corridors, the elevator lobbies, the service areas, those get value engineered down because buyers and renters don't inspect them the way they inspect the kitchen countertops.
The granite in your bathroom is doing a lot of emotional compensation for the stained carpet 2 steps outside your door.
And the maintenance question she raised is arguably the single most important thing to investigate before moving into a tower, whether renting or buying. Because in a mid-rise walk-up, if the stairwell needs painting, you're dealing with maybe a dozen units splitting the cost. In a 40-story tower, you're now in a complex governance structure with hundreds of stakeholders, a professional management company that may or may not be attentive, and capital reserve studies that may or may not be adequately funded.
This is the part where I'd want to see the minutes from the last 3 condo board meetings.
That's the single best piece of due diligence anyone can do. Those board minutes will tell you things the listing agent never will. Is there a pending special assessment for elevator modernization? Are they fighting with the developer over construction defects? Has the reserve fund been drained by unexpected facade work? These are not hypotheticals. There was a well-documented case in Miami where a luxury tower had to impose a $15 million special assessment for concrete restoration, and individual owners were suddenly on the hook for six-figure payments they hadn't budgeted for.
That's ownership. As a renter, you're insulated from the special assessment, but you're not insulated from the scaffolding.
Right. The disruption hits you either way. And that brings us to the renting versus buying question, which is where this gets interesting for towers specifically. Hannah said she'd probably rent in a tower but not buy, and I think that instinct is correct for reasons that go beyond personal preference.
Walk me through that.
When you buy an apartment in a tower, you're buying two things that are weirdly decoupled. You're buying a private unit, which you can control, and you're buying a fractional share of a building system that you have almost no control over. The elevator system, the HVAC infrastructure, the facade, the roof, the parking structure, the fire suppression system. All of these are shared assets governed collectively. And the taller the building, the more complex and expensive those shared systems are, and the less influence any individual owner has over their management.
Your voting share shrinks as the floor count rises.
In a 10-unit building, you're 10% of the decision. In a 300-unit tower, you're a rounding error. And the decisions still get made, they just get made by a board that may or may not share your priorities about maintenance standards or reserve funding levels.
You're exposed to the downside of collective decision-making without the intimacy of a small collective.
The costs scale non-linearly with height. There's a well-known phenomenon in real estate economics called the height-cost curve. Beyond about 12 to 15 stories, the per square foot construction cost starts climbing steeply. You need more robust structural systems, more sophisticated mechanical systems, more elevator capacity, more stringent fire safety measures. All of that translates into higher monthly maintenance fees for owners. And those fees only go up over time as systems age.
I've seen some numbers on this. What's the rough premium?
A study from the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat found that operating costs in towers above 30 stories can run 30 to 40% higher per square foot than in mid-rise buildings. And that's not even accounting for major capital replacements. When the elevators need a full modernization after 20 or 25 years, you're looking at millions.
Renting in a tower means you get the view, the light, the amenities, the trash chute, and someone else eats the long-term capital risk.
Someone else eats the capital risk, and you retain the option to leave if the building's maintenance trajectory starts heading in the wrong direction. That option value is worth something. It's hard to quantify, but it's real. If you buy, and 5 years later the common areas have deteriorated further, the management company has turned over 3 times, and the reserve fund is underfunded, you're stuck. Selling a unit in a building with a reputation for poor maintenance is punishing.
The market prices that in eventually. It just takes a while.
By the time it's priced in, you've already lived through the decline. So Hannah's instinct to rent in a tower rather than buy is well supported by the economics and the governance structure. But I want to push back on something she said because I think there's more to the family life question than she's giving credit to.
She said she wouldn't want to raise multiple children there long term.
And I understand that instinct. The conventional wisdom is that towers are for singles, couples, empty nesters, not for families with young kids. But the data on this is actually more mixed than the stereotype suggests. There was a fascinating longitudinal study out of Melbourne that tracked families raising children in high-rise apartments over a decade. And what they found was that the negative outcomes people worry about, social isolation, lack of outdoor play, developmental delays, those were not inherent to height. They were mediated almost entirely by design factors and neighborhood context. If the building had usable common outdoor space, if the neighborhood was walkable with parks nearby, if the unit itself had adequate bedrooms and sound isolation, the outcomes were comparable to low-rise living.
It's not the tower. It's whether the tower is designed for families or designed for bachelor pads.
And most towers are designed for the latter because that's what the developer imagines the market to be. But when families do move in, and they increasingly are in expensive cities, they adapt. They use the building differently. And the buildings that work for them tend to share certain features. Generous lobby spaces where kids can actually exist without being shushed. Soundproofing between units that's good enough that a crying baby doesn't trigger neighbor warfare. Elevators that are large enough for strollers.
The stroller test. If your elevator can't fit a stroller and 2 adults, you don't live in a family building.
It sounds trivial, but it's a genuine daily friction point. You don't think about it until you're folding a stroller, one-handed, while holding a baby and a grocery bag in an elevator the size of a phone booth, and then you think about it constantly.
Hannah mentioned they have one baby. One baby in a well-designed tower unit with good light and space can actually be quite pleasant. Two toddlers, different story.
The calculus shifts fast, because now you're managing multiple nap schedules in a shared corridor environment. You're doing double the stroller logistics. Your tolerance for thin walls drops to zero. And your need for immediate outdoor access, not a 10-minute elevator wait lobby walk journey, becomes non-negotiable.
The elevator wait alone becomes a quality of life variable that nobody accounts for in the listing.
That's one of the hidden surprises people report. In a mid-rise walk-up, you control your pace. In a tower, you're at the mercy of the elevator algorithm. And during peak hours, morning commute, evening return, you can spend a surprising amount of time just waiting. Some buildings have optimized their elevator systems well, others haven't. And it's not something you can easily test during a showing at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday.
You'd need to loiter in the lobby at 8:15 a.m. and see what actually happens.
Which is exactly the kind of due diligence that sounds obsessive but pays off enormously. Talk to residents. Hang out in the lobby. Ride the elevators at different times. Check if the trash chute actually works, or if there's a sign apologizing for it being out of service. Those signs are the canary in the maintenance coal mine.
The apology sign as diagnostic tool.
It's remarkably reliable. A building where management promptly fixes things doesn't need apology signs. A building where the signs are laminated and yellowing tells you everything you need to know.
Let's talk about the positive surprises. Hannah walked in skeptical and came out excited. What are the things that actually delight people about tower living that they don't anticipate?
The big one is light. And I don't just mean a nice view. I mean the quality and quantity of natural light you get above the tree line and above neighboring buildings. In a dense city, ground level and low-rise apartments are often fighting for light. You're looking into someone else's window, or you're shaded by the building across the street. At 30 floors up, you're getting unobstructed light from multiple directions for most of the day. That has real psychological and physiological effects.
There's solid research on this, right? Light exposure and mood.
Circadian regulation, vitamin D synthesis, seasonal affective disorder mitigation. A study in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine found that office workers with windows got 46 more minutes of sleep per night than those without. Now that's an office study, but the principle translates directly to residential spaces. More natural light, better sleep, better mood. And in a tower, you're getting light that low-rise units simply can't access.
The psychological effect of looking down at the city rather than across at a brick wall.
There's a reason the penthouse commands a premium. It's not just status signaling. It's a genuine shift in how you experience your home. You feel removed from the street noise. You feel privacy. In a dense urban environment, eye-level windows mean you either keep your blinds closed or accept that your neighbors can see into your living room. In a tower, the only things at eye level are birds and drones.
Other towers, depending on the orientation.
Right. The fishbowl effect can still happen if you're facing another tower at similar height. But generally, the higher you go, the fewer sightlines into your unit from outside. That's a real privacy benefit that people don't fully appreciate until they've lived with it.
What about the sound thing? I'd expect towers to be quieter.
They are, but with an asterisk. Street noise drops off dramatically above about the 10th floor. Sirens, traffic, construction, bar crowds, all of that fades. What replaces it is wind noise, which is a different acoustic profile. Some people find it soothing, some find it unsettling. And then there's the internal sound transmission, which depends entirely on construction quality. A well-built concrete tower can be nearly silent between units. A poorly built one can transmit impact noise, footsteps from above, plumbing sounds, in ways that are actually harder to fix than in a wood frame low rise.
Because concrete conducts sound differently.
Impact noise travels through the structural frame. If someone drops something on a hard floor 3 units above you, you might hear it more clearly than the unit directly next to them. It's counterintuitive.
The acoustic privacy is better in some ways, and worse in others, and you won't know which until you're in.
Which is why I always suggest, if you're serious about a unit, ask the neighbors, not the ones the agent introduces you to. Just knock on a door on a different floor and say you're considering moving in. People are surprisingly candid. They'll tell you about the elevator wait times, the noise issues, the management responsiveness, the things the listing won't mention.
The unauthorized resident survey. It's the apartment equivalent of reading the one-star reviews first.
It's especially important in towers because the variance between buildings is enormous. Two towers next to each other, same year, same developer, can have completely different living experiences based on management quality, resident composition, and maintenance history.
Let's go back to something Hannah mentioned that I think deserves more attention. The institutional hallway feel. That's not just an aesthetic complaint, it's a design failure with real consequences.
And it's almost universal in residential towers. The corridor is treated as leftover space. You maximize saleable square footage in the units, and the hallway is whatever's left after you fit the floor plate. It's long, it's narrow, it's artificially lit, it has no natural light, it has no seating, it has no variation. It's a pure circulation machine.
The hallway is conveyor belt.
The problem is that in a building where you might have 40 units on a floor, the hallway is the first thing you see when you leave your home and the last thing you see before you enter it. It sets the emotional tone for arrival and departure. If it feels institutional, your home feels slightly less like a home every time you walk through that threshold.
Some architects have tried to address this, right? Breaking up the corridor, adding light wells?
There are some good examples. The Aqua Tower in Chicago by Studio Gang has undulating balconies that break up the facade and create varied sightlines. Some newer towers in Vancouver have introduced skip-stop elevator systems where you only have corridors every three floors, and the units are duplexes or triplexes with internal stairs. That reduces the corridor footprint dramatically and makes the shared spaces feel more intimate, but these are exceptions. The standard developer tower is still a double-loaded corridor with identical doors stretching to the vanishing point.
The Overlook Hotel School of Residential Design.
And that sameness has a psychological effect. There's research in environmental psychology showing that long, undifferentiated corridors increase stress and reduce sense of belonging. People walk faster, they make less eye contact, they feel less connected to neighbors. It's literally alienating architecture.
Hannah's observation about the hallway isn't picky. It's identifying the exact design feature that most undermines the sense of home in a tower.
It's one of those things you can't fix as a resident. You can paint your unit, you can furnish it beautifully, you can make it feel personal and warm, but the hallway belongs to the building. It will always be what it is.
That's the fundamental asymmetry of tower living. You have total control over a small percentage of your daily experience and zero control over the rest.
That's where the governance question becomes existential. In a well-managed building, the common spaces are maintained, improved, cared for. In a poorly managed one, they degrade, and you watch it happen in slow motion with no ability to intervene unilaterally.
Let's structure this for someone in Hannah's position. You're considering renting in a tower. What's the checklist?
First, evaluate the building's age and maintenance history. Anything over about 15 years is entering the zone where major systems start needing attention. Elevators, facade sealants, mechanical systems. Ask about the reserve fund. A healthy reserve fund should have enough to cover predictable capital replacements without special assessments. If the building is newer, under 5 years, ask about construction defect litigation. It's shockingly common.
The first 5 years of a tower's life are often spent in court.
Not an exaggeration. A study of condo development in several major North American cities found that roughly 30% of new towers had filed construction defect claims within the first 7 years. Water intrusion is the most common issue. In a tall building, water management is extraordinarily complex, and if the envelope isn't detailed perfectly, you get leaks. Leaks lead to mold. Mold leads to litigation. And during litigation, maintenance often gets deferred because nobody wants to spend money while the legal outcome is uncertain.
You're living in a building that's slowly deteriorating while lawyers argue about who pays to fix it.
As a renter, you can leave. As an owner, you're funding the legal fees through your assessments. That's another point in the rent column for tower specifically.
Second item on the checklist?
Test the elevators at peak times. I cannot stress this enough. Ride them at 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. Time the wait. See if they're crowded. See if one is out of service. Elevator reliability and speed are the single biggest daily friction point in tower living, and the listing will never tell you about it. Evaluate the common area condition honestly. Not just the lobby, which is always staged to look good, the corridors on the residential floors, the elevator interiors, the parking garage, the trash room. If these spaces feel neglected, that's a management problem, and management problems don't self-correct.
Fourth, talk to residents.
Fifth, understand the sound isolation. This is harder to test during a showing, but you can get clues. Are the interior walls concrete or drywall? Concrete is better for airborne sound, but can transmit impact noise. Are there acoustic underlayments under the flooring? Does the building have rules about hard flooring versus carpet? Some towers require carpet in a percentage of the unit specifically to reduce impact noise transmission to the unit below.
That's a thing?
Very much a thing, and it's a frequent source of neighbor disputes. Someone installs hardwood throughout, the downstairs neighbor suddenly hears every footstep, and now you're in a building-wide flooring war.
The domestic politics of acoustic transmission.
It's one of the top three sources of conflict in multi-unit residential buildings, along with short-term rentals and pet policies. And in a tower, the number of neighbors means these conflicts are statistically more likely to affect you even if you're not directly involved.
Hannah's tower has the positives she mentioned. View, light, high ceilings, amenities. The question is whether the common area condition she's already noticed is a yellow flag or a red one.
From her description, I'd say yellow. She said the common areas don't feel particularly well maintained, but the building is relatively new. That pattern, good units, mediocre commons, is consistent with a management company that's cutting costs on cleaning and maintenance staffing. It's not structural yet, but it's a leading indicator. If the management company isn't investing in visible maintenance, they're almost certainly not investing in invisible maintenance either. The mechanical systems, the roof, the facade inspections.
The things you can see are quietly getting worse while the lobby carpet gets shabbier.
The shabby carpet is your early warning system. If they're not replacing something as cheap and visible as corridor carpet, they're definitely not doing the expensive stuff.
The advice to Hannah would be, the yellow flag means do the due diligence. Check the board minutes. Ask about the reserve fund. Talk to residents about management responsiveness.
Trust the excitement. She walked in and loved it. That's real information. The visceral response to a space matters. You can't reduce a home decision entirely to a spreadsheet. The light, the view, the feeling of being up high looking out over the city, that's valuable. It will make her happier on a daily basis. The question is whether the building's management trajectory threatens to undermine that over time.
As a renter, her exposure to that trajectory is limited. If the building declines, she can move. The cost of moving is real, but it's finite. The cost of being stuck in a declining building as an owner is potentially much larger.
That's the asymmetry that makes renting in the tower, even a tower with some yellow flags, a reasonable bet. You're capturing the upside, the space, the light, the experience, while capping the downside. The downside cap is your lease term.
What about the urban planning objection? She still holds that towers aren't generally the best model for cities. Does living in one make you complicit in something you oppose?
I don't think so. The tower exists whether she rents in it or not. Her individual housing choice doesn't change the planning calculus. And there's a reasonable argument that having architecture critics actually live in the building types they critique produces better criticism. You understand the trade-offs from the inside.
The embedded critic, like a war correspondent, but for floor plans.
She'll emerge from this with a much more nuanced understanding of why people choose towers despite their drawbacks. The view isn't just a luxury indulgence, it's a genuine experiential upgrade that makes daily life feel different. The light, as we discussed, has health implications. The amenities solve real problems. The trash chute alone is a quality of life improvement that's hard to overstate when you have a baby and you're generating more waste than you ever thought possible.
The diaper logistics alone.
Imagine carrying a bag of diapers down 30 flights of stairs because the trash chute is broken. Now imagine that's your Tuesday.
That's the kind of detail that doesn't make it into architecture criticism, but absolutely defines the living experience.
That's what I think Hannah's prompt gets at that most discussions of tower living miss. The theory and the practice diverge in ways that are deeply personal and situational. You can hold a principled position against towers as urban form and still find that a specific tower, at a specific moment in your life, with a specific set of needs, is exactly the right choice.
The principled position survives the exception. You're not a hypocrite for finding a good apartment.
You're a person navigating a constrained housing market with a baby and a limited set of options. The fact that the option you ended up liking contradicts your architectural priors is interesting, but it's not disqualifying. It's data.
To summarize the trade-offs for someone in Hannah's position, renting in a tower gives you light, views, amenities, and insulation from capital risk. The downsides are the institutional common spaces, the elevator dependency, the governance lottery, and the risk that management quality declines over your tenancy. For a family with one baby, it can work well if the building is designed with families in mind, or at least not hostile to them. For multiple children, the friction compounds.
The buying versus renting question is unusually stark for towers. The governance dilution, the height cost curve, the capital replacement risk, and the difficulty of exiting a building with a declining reputation all push toward renting as the more prudent choice unless you're very confident in the building's long-term management and financial health.
Which most people can't be because most people aren't forensic accountants with engineering backgrounds.
The information asymmetry between the seller and the buyer in a tower transaction is enormous. The seller knows about the pending special assessment, the construction defect claim, the elevator modernization study that's been commissioned but not yet acted on. The buyer sees granite countertops and a view.
The granite as informational decoy.
It works on all of us. We're visual creatures. We walk into a beautiful space and our critical faculties dim. That's not a character flaw, it's human cognition. The countermeasure is process. Checklists, inspections, document review, resident interviews. The unsexy stuff that feels excessive until it saves you from a six-figure mistake.
For Hannah, the stakes are lower because she's renting. She can afford to trust the excitement a bit more. The worst case is she moves in, the building's management turns out to be worse than expected, and in a year or two she moves out. That's not nothing. Moving is miserable, but it's not catastrophic.
Moving with a baby is its own special circle of difficulty. But yes, the risk is bounded. And the upside is, she gets to live in a space that made her feel excited during a demoralizing housing search. That's worth something real.
The demoralization of apartment hunting is its own topic. When you've seen enough disappointing units, finding one that sparks genuine excitement is almost intoxicating.
The bar gets lowered so far that a room with adequate light feels like a revelation. And then you walk into a high-floor unit with floor-to-ceiling windows and suddenly you're not comparing it to other apartments. You're comparing it to how you want to feel when you wake up in the morning.
That's the thing the planning critiques don't capture. The experiential dimension. The feeling of being up high, above the noise, looking out at the city. It's not rational, exactly. But it's real.
It's real, and it's measurable in cortisol levels and sleep quality and self-reported life satisfaction. The view isn't just a view. It's a daily dose of something that makes you feel less trapped, less compressed, less ground down by the density of urban life.
You're in this city, but not of it. The detachment is the feature.
That detachment is exactly what some people need to thrive in an urban environment. Not everyone wants to be embedded in the street life. Some people want to observe it from a quiet perch and then descend into it on their own terms.
The tower is observation deck for your own city.
When you have a baby, that quiet perch becomes more valuable, not less. You're already overstimulated by the demands of parenting. Having a home that feels calm and removed and full of light is restorative.
The final takeaway for Hannah. Her excitement is justified. Her caution about the common areas is warranted. Her instinct to rent rather than buy is well supported. And her architectural skepticism can coexist peacefully with her enjoyment of this specific apartment.
The coexistence of critique and appreciation is the mature position. Dogmatism is for people who don't have to actually live somewhere. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, a guild of Flemish tapestry weavers in Bruges developed an initiation ritual so elaborate that new members had to weave a complete miniature tapestry while blindfolded, using only threads they had personally dyed with pigments sourced within the city walls. The ritual was discontinued after a candidate accidentally wove a portrait of the guildmaster as a goat, and the guildmaster, rather than being offended, declared it the finest likeness ever made of him, and retired in humiliation.
Right.
That's a lot to process.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show.
We're back next week with another prompt.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.